Welcome to Vicom's weekly podcast. This is our 50th episode. We have a bumper selection of guests to discuss the fallout of the Israeli election and what is next in Israeli politics and looking ahead to a US peace plan. Our first guest is Natan Sachs, who's the director of the Middle East program at Brookings in Washington, D.C. Hi, Natan. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
First of all, I wanted to ask you, looking at now the election results, the coalition is sort of negotiations beginning. What was your big surprise of this election?
Well, in some ways, it's a bit anticlimactic because we're going to see a similar Netanyahu coalition. So I guess the top line is, you know, the more things change, the more they stay the same. But there are some surprises. First, the two large parties, Likud and Blue and White, are considerably larger than any other party. This harkens back a bit to the early 90s or even the 80s, where there were two dominant parties. Then it was Likud and Labor, and everyone else was very small. And the offshoot of that is that a lot of the other parties are not far from the minimum threshold of getting into the Knesset. And so a lot of the drama going in and certainly after is on which parties managed to pass this threshold or not. So first, that just structure. We didn't see that coming. I didn't see it coming anyway. Two very dominant parties and then a lot of small parties. Second, the parties that didn't pass, two stand out. One is the lesser of the two, is Zehut, which was supposed to be the surprise of the election. Sort of a very strange party, honestly, touting a libertarian, American-style libertarian approach, meaning extreme freedom from government. What caught the headlines was legalization of marijuana in the context of that extreme freedom. But the thing is that the head of that party was also a very extreme right-winger on other issues, especially on Temple Mount and Jerusalem and other things. And so we had this sort of very strange phenomenon where people on the center and even on the left might be voting for this strange new party. In the end, it didn't pass, which is a surprise given the polls. And the biggest surprise, perhaps, is that a party called the New Right, headed by, or formed, in fact, by Naftali Bennett and Ayelet Shaked, the two quite senior ministers from what was the Jewish Home, they left the Jewish Home, founded this new party. Their hope was to create an alternative to the Likud, or at least something that could join with the Likud later as they called it, the New Right, and to allow them, both of them, in fact, to run in the future as potential prime ministers, instead of in a niche party of the national religious, the Jewish Home, instead to be a part of the center-right kind of amalgam of Likud and maybe the New Right. They didn't pass the threshold, which is a stunning defeat for them personally. They're both popular, especially Ayelet Shaked. She's very popular on the right. And them not passing is quite consequential, too. They'll not be in the next Knesset and almost certainly not in the next cabinet as well. So that's certainly a surprise, too.
Do you think that's just a case of like Bennett? Just, I mean, as an entrepreneur, as a businessman, he did something quite rare. I mean, he misread his market, he rebranded. And it turned out people wanted like the original, and then the Jewish Home Party that he left ended up getting into the Knesset. And he kind of misread that whole situation, how big the market was even.
Yes, I think there's a misreading. You know, first, just their brand itself was not enough to bring voters to them. Last time, too, in fact, as head of the Jewish Home, they suffered from a pull towards the Likud, towards Netanyahu's party by Netanyahu in the last minute. And they probably suffered from the same thing here. If Netanyahu would not manage to galvanize the right wing behind him to face off the opposition, Blue and White, the New Right would almost certainly have passed. They were extremely close. They were about 1,500 votes shy of passing. And so that's almost certainly part of it. The other part is that the right wing has suffered in the past from this. It's just a multiplicity of right wing parties that are quite similar to one another. So they formed the New Right. What they left behind created something called the Union of Right Wing Parties. That's hard to distinguish from far away. It's also hard to distinguish in Israel. There are differences in ideology, but still. And the result was that just a splitting of the vote is really the fundamental problem here, combined with this, what I described earlier, the two very large parties and a lot of small ones. So the Likud becoming so big came at the expense of other parties, in particular, New Right.
And a lot of them suffered. Looking ahead to what happens now, I mean, there's coalition negotiations, and I think one of the really big questions that's going to emerge is how is Prime Minister Netanyahu going to deal with these corruption allegations and a potential indictment formally from the Attorney General after he's had a hearing? There's all sorts of options that were on the table before and that could evolve, whether there'll be immunity from prosecution passed under existing laws, whether some kind of new law will be passed in the new Knesset. I mean, how much do you forecast that these might happen. I mean, before the election, people were saying that, you know, that this probably is very unlikely, that there will be certain Knesset members, even who support Netanyahu, will say, look, they're just not prepared to bend the system to his situation. That's too much of a kind of bending of the legal framework. I mean, do you see this, that people perhaps have misread this and this could just happen in the next few months?
The short answer is that it is possible. I also thought it's unlikely before the election, and I still think it's unlikely. Most likely, it will not pass, or at least pass in a form that would survive a court challenge. What they would want to do is one of two things, as you described. Either they change the existing law, which grants some immunity to members of Knesset so that they conduct their business without fear of prosecution by the police, and that's a reasonable law to have already. In the past, that law stated that any member of Knesset had immunity from any prosecution unless a majority of the Knesset removed that immunity. And if they just returned to that, that was a law until 2005. If they just returned to that, then Netanyahu as a member of Knesset would be immune from prosecution unless the Knesset turned on him. So, of course, would make him even more beholden to a majority in the Knesset, but it would grant him immunity while he's prime minister or while he's a member of Knesset, actually. The second option is that they actually pass immunity in what's known in Israel as the French law, something that would be similar to France, where chief executive, where the president has immunity from prosecution while in office. If that passed, it would seem very personal. It would seem targeted specifically towards Netanyahu. That is already not true to form. Usually legislation should not be personal towards one person. And secondly, it has a retroactive aspect to it, since he's investigations, and in fact, even the preliminary decision to indict has already been made. That I still think would be unpopular enough that enough members of Knesset would not do it. But I'm saying this in a sense of I think, I don't know. And in part, my prediction is tempered by the fact that I think I was probably wrong on something else that I thought. I thought that the chance that Netanyahu could continue to serve as prime minister even after indictment was very low. We had several politicians, including those in his future coalition, who said that that would be a bridge too far. They would not, if indicted, he should resign, as did a former prime minister, Ehud Olmert. And in fact, Netanyahu was demanding that Olmert resign at the time. That I'm not sure at all is still true. I may have been wrong. The new mandate that Netanyahu got from the public gives political cover to others to perhaps stay while he's indicted. And moreover, the weakness of the small parties means that they have an interest to join the Likud, maybe even truly combine with the Likud in the future as one party. That's especially true of a centrist party called Kulanu, headed by the finance minister, Kahlon. He may very well want to return to the Likud from where he comes. And to do that, he certainly would not want to turn on the Likud, the popular Likud leader. I don't know how long that would last. If indicted, Netanyahu may eventually have to resign under coalition pressure. But I don't think it's as soon as I thought before the election. I think I just may have been wrong on that.
So, I mean, the process going forward, just for our listeners, is that the next thing that happens is Netanyahu's lawyers have a hearing with the attorney general, which will take place either before the summer or maybe slightly later. And then after that, the attorney general makes his final decision and formally indicts the prime minister, and then it moves towards a court case. So there's still some time to run here.
And I'll just add that the lawyers of Netanyahu have the ability also to stall a lot of this because they have to give material, receive material, review it. All this can take many months, especially if they're dragging their feet. And these are going to be very good lawyers who know how to drag their feet when they decide it's in their interest.
Yeah. So there's a long time to run. On another issue that's potentially going to really influence or not what happens with coalition negotiations and then, you know, the first months of the new government is the so-called U.S. peace plan, the what's been called the deal of the century by President Trump, or the what I like to call just a plan for Israeli-Palestinian talks in some guise. There's a lot of expectation. We've been hearing for a very long time from the U.S. team, Jared Kushner, Jonathan Greenblatt, Ambassador Friedman, that this plan is imminent. They talked originally that it might come after the elections. Now it sounds like it might come after the government has been formed. I really wanted to get your sense. I mean, you're there in Washington, D.C. You're part of this conversation. Do we think this plan is imminent? And if so, what on earth is going to be in it?
Yeah. That's the million-dollar question. So first, I have not read the plan. We do know that it's a thick plan. It's a detailed one. They took a very different approach to previous such plans. Previously, American administrations have usually had short, very carefully worded, almost litigated proposals. So they would talk about Jerusalem, and every word was chosen very carefully to make sure that all sides could live with this proposal, or at least were forced to make a decision that the United States wanted them to make. This plan, or vision, as they like to call it, will be different. This will be very detailed. It'll try to spell out in plain English, I guess, perhaps translated too, for ordinary Israelis and Palestinians, what an end state would look like in the American vision. And their hope, I think it's far-fetched, but their hope is that if ordinary citizens read it, for example, ordinary Palestinians, they will then pressure their leadership to accept it because they will see that their lives will be better. I think that's a remote possibility, but that is, I think, the theory of the case for them. The possibility that it's going to be presented is still very much on the table. Never say never, in the sense that we might find that it's actually the reverse, that we're always going to be anticipating this plan, and there's always going to be excuse not to do it. So the elections was one excuse. Now the formation of the government is probably the next one. Then there's Ramadan, which is a bad time to do it on the Palestinian side. And then we're approaching an American election year where there could be other considerations coming in as well, even more than in usual times. So it may never come. I still do think, I'm not sure, I still do think they are going to present it. And it very much depends also on what the Israelis, of course, tell them. And if they do present it, what we're likely to see is the Israelis, as they usually do, say yes to the plan, but we have a few very important reservations. So a big yes, but kind of answer. Those reservations will be very significant, probably, depending on what's in the plan. And the Palestinians will reject the plan. They've already said they will. The moves by the Trump administration vis-a-vis the Palestinians in the past 2 years have antagonized the Palestinians dramatically. And in the past year and a half almost, there hasn't been official diplomatic contact between the two sides, so much so that the Israelis have now more contact with the Palestinians than the American administration, if you can believe it. So the result is that the chance of Palestinians accepted is very low. And then the big question, and this I think will be very consequential, is what happens immediately after that. It is possible that the Israeli government, the new coalition, will decide to move unilaterally on some issues, and the Americans perhaps will have already understood that from the Israelis, and moreover may take a blanket Palestinian no, an unwillingness by the Palestinians to engage, as a snub to the United States, perhaps to the president himself. We may see more sort of sense of retribution from the United States towards the Palestinians that would give license, perhaps, for unwise steps on the Israeli side.
I mean, it's clear that if this plan doesn't say that there'll be a Palestinian state and make some statement about Jerusalem being the capital of that state, that it will not only be rejected by the Palestinians, it will also be rejected by a lot of the Arab states. I mean, it seems to me that we're sitting here between, you know, two possibilities. Number one, there is this whole plan, and it's essentially just a plan for economic development, and it's very, very vague on the final issues of borders and state, and it sort of, I don't know, maybe just says we're going to leave this to the parties, or it actually is much more prescriptive. But if it is more prescriptive, then it actually does talk about a Palestinian state, it has a better chance maybe of being accepted by Arab states. But do you think there's a possibility that they'll just do this whole plan, that it'll just talk about economic development, it'll be very, very vague on the really important issues for the Palestinians, and yet the US will just still talk about this plan in a very kind of Trump way as just being amazing, and they'll just kind of almost want to shut out any views that this is actually not just an incredible, incredible plan? Can you see that happening?
I could see it happening. I think you're certainly right that I think the bulk of this plan will have to do with economic steps. And I think that's part of what they hope will be new, a very large economic initiative with a lot of external money, perhaps from the Gulf, coming in to build the Palestinian economy. You know, people always talk about a Marshall Plan in the Middle East. It's almost by now cliche, but this would sort of try to be that. A huge influx of capital to not just revive, but build the Palestinian economy and also benefit others in the meantime. That said, they do insist, and I think it's very likely, that there is also some detail on the political side, on what happens with borders, Jerusalem, refugees, security. And that's, of course, where the rubber will hit the road. As you said, that's exactly where it is. I assume that that will also be detailed. If it's such a detailed long plan, that probably will also be detailed. They may try to get away with not saying the word Palestinian state, although that would be very strange, and it would ensure that Palestinians and other Arabs would not accept it. But if it does say state, it may say state on terms that Netanyahu could live with. He's spoken in the past of a Palestinian state. He's spoken of a state minus, so certainly demilitarized, but other aspects too. And how they manage to square that is, of course, the question. I hope I'm wrong. This is a very easy prediction because I truly hope I'm wrong. But it doesn't seem to me like they'll be able to do it in a way that would genuinely bring the Palestinians and most of the Arabs behind it. They may do enough to get some tacit support from some of the Arab states that have been very close to the Trump administration, perhaps the Saudis, perhaps the Emiratis. But to be able to get others, especially the Jordanians, for example, and the Palestinians themselves, that will be hard. And especially if on issues like Jerusalem, they cross the line or don't cross the line the Palestinians need them to, that's a card the Palestinians have that they can wield even vis-a-vis other Arab countries, because Jerusalem is still a very emotive issue. It doesn't mean that the Arab street will start burning things, not necessarily. It may all go quietly. It's a rather cynical time now. But still, the possibility that Arab states would go along with something on Jerusalem that the Palestinians attack, you know, would still be hard to do.
And also, I mean, if it says anything about settlements and talks about evacuating settlements or talks even about where settlements can and cannot be, then that will also cause problems for the coalition. The Yisrael Beiteinu and this United Right Party and even some people in the Likud will oppose that vigorously. So you know, this could potentially be interesting. Thank you so much, Natan, for joining us. And, you know, we've covered a lot of ground there. And, you know, it's been a real pleasure to have you on. Thank you so much.
James, thank you very much. It's my pleasure.
And for my second guest for this week, I'm delighted to have with me Haviv Retigur, who's a political analyst, regular contributor to the Times of Israel. Haviv, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
What I really wanted to talk to you about is really, I suppose, the impact of this election. And there's been a lot of talk around the world. There's been a lot of focus as well in kind of the UK media on some of the big themes here. You know, has Israel lurched more to the right? You know, are we looking at a much more divided society? And what are the implications, you know, for these institutions of the rule of law as we go into a situation where there's a prime minister who's facing, you know, indictments for corruption? So if I could start with the first question, do you think that the election was really about Israel moving much more to the right?
I have a hard time with these kinds of interpretations, because a lot of times what they're really, they're not really referring a country moving to the right. It's not really a reference to something that is happening to the people themselves living in the country. It's a reference to the perception of them from overseas. So, for example, Barack Obama once famously chided Israelis that they were abandoning their liberal history, their liberal traditions of people like Golda Meir and Levi Eshkol and these sort of iconic Israeli leaders. And a lot of Israelis were startled by this statement, because Israel today is vastly, vastly, vastly more liberal than it was in the 70s until 1966. The Jews of Israel still thought they were at war with the Arab Israelis, Arab citizens of Israel, who were under military rule until 66. On every measure you can imagine, integration of minorities in the workforce, whether the ultra-Orthodox, you know, participation in all fields of Israeli economy, of the Israeli society, minority rights, questions of gay rights and openness to gay relationships by the institutions of the state, which now recognize many, many gay relationships. There is no measure that you can actually specifically name by which Israel is not more liberal today than it was, for example, 20 years ago and certainly 40 years ago. Mm. I think what has changed is that Israel used to symbolize for a lot of foreign observers, some of them who, you know, passionately love Israel, a lot of Jewish communities around the world, a kind of symbolic sort of historical justice and all good things. And Israel is now seen much more realistically. And also there are now entire campaigns, of course, to depict Israel in quite demonic ways. And those are changing the perception from abroad. All of that is to say, Israel did not lurch right in this election. What happened, and what has been happening since the 2000, really, for the last 19 years, and what keeps getting Benjamin Netanyahu elected, is that Israelis perceive a problem and they don't see a solution.
Yeah.
They see a problem in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Every Israeli withdrawal, and there have been many, many Israeli withdrawals. Israel's pulled out of probably 85% of the land it conquered in 1967, and it most recently pulled out of Gaza in 2005. That's not so long ago. And South Lebanon in 2000, which was, there was no Israeli claim there, it was just a military position, but still it pulled out. Every single place that it has pulled out of has been filled by bad guys, by, you know, by Islamists of one ilk or another. And so the whole question of Israelis today believe that a withdrawal from the West Bank is no longer possible. And if they believe that a withdrawal from the West Bank is no longer possible, the old division between right and left no longer makes sense. So we know that there are right-wing parties like, for example, the Kulanu party, that draws votes from people who tell pollsters that they're left-wing,
yeah,
and then goes and sits in Benjamin Netanyahu's coalition. Because the old definition of left-wing, which was separate from the Palestinians, establish a Palestinian state, no longer makes sense because it doesn't seem possible. So,
well,
no, Israel has not moved to the right in terms of, in any deep sense, in any sense of... Please.
On that issue, I think the way some people interpret it is they'd say they understand this thing about not feeling like there's an immediate solution or an immediate partner. So they judge whether Israel has moved to the right on the basis of whether they are prepared to still preserve the conditions for that kind of agreement in the future. And when they see a much more normalized debate about applying Israeli sovereignty to Israeli settlements, or about actually annexing parts of the West Bank and making them a part of the state of Israel, they interpret that as, well, that's your lurch to the right. If you're starting to close off those key pillars of what makes a two-state solution possible, you're kind of saying, well, we don't think there's ever going to be a two-state solution. So is that not evidence? If you've got parts of the Likud and you've got a united right party that's been elected, and maybe even some bits of Yisrael Beitenu who are maybe more relaxed about applying Israeli sovereignty to big chunks of the West Bank or some of those big settlement blocks, does that not show that there's evidence of that move to the right?
I would put it like this. On narrow policy grounds, on specific policy grounds, I think that it's definitely legitimate to be concerned about whether or not an Israel that cannot withdraw from the West Bank, or doesn't believe it can forever hold itself prepared to withdraw, right?
Mm.
And whether it has that political capacity. The normalization of the talk of annexation is, again, not a lurch to the right in the sense that that is historically what the Likud party has stood for. It has been in the Likud platform at least since 2000 and was a commonly stated by Likud leaders in the 70s and 80s. So it became unfashionable to say it out loud when you think that the Americans are listening in the 90s on the Israeli right. But it didn't go away. And if there is no way to pull out, and not for generations, then the Israelis are asking themselves, you know, I'm not going to invest politically in holding us frozen in place without... I would say like this, if people concerned about the two-state solution should be concerned. The idea that an Israeli political shift is what's causing the slow erosion of the two-state solution is not the Israeli experience. We still have today, we have a very serious survey from, I think, 2-3 weeks ago by the Israel Democracy Institute, a prominent and respected think tank in Israel, that says to Israelis, you know, if a separation were possible, do you want it? And there is still a majority that wants it. And then the question is it possible? And then suddenly you discover that almost no Israelis, and by the way, relatively few Israeli Arabs actually believe it's possible. When the Palestinian side becomes capable of reciprocating an Israeli withdrawal like the Gaza withdrawal, with quiet, with peace, with security, everything might change. Until then, it's hard for the center and the left in Israel to make an argument against the right that says, oh, no, don't annex. There's no partner. We're not going anywhere. We're going to stand here for 40 years. We agree that this is in fundamental sort of narrative terms. This is part of our homeland, but still don't annex. We want to separate 45 years from now when it might be possible. That's a very hard argument to make in a political debate.
Yeah. Moving on to the issue about the election that was very much, you know, do you want Bibi to lead you or do you want Bibi to leave you? And this idea that, you know, we had a very large number of votes for the Blue and White Party and a very large number of votes for Likud and a dead heat in terms of seats. And I think, you know, looking at it from the outside, it seems like Israel is very, very divided between those who basically are very happy for Bibi to still lead them, or at least believe he's the least worst option, and those people that really wanted him to go. What does that mean now for the next few years, and how is that going to sort of permeate through the wider discussion in Israeli society?
I think also, you know, again, these divides are not new, and I think that they're going to stay with us for a long time. A great, great deal of the divide is ethnic in among the Jews. A huge number of those Likud voters are Mizrahi Jews from the Muslim world and the Arab world, and, you know, disproportionate number, and a disproportionate number of the votes against Likud and against Bibi and for Blue and White are Ashkenazi Jews, and you see that in the distribution. So in the Tel Aviv area, in the predominantly Ashkenazi areas, you had numbers for a huge lead for Blue and White, and in very, very Mizrahi areas like the small towns of the Negev and places like that, huge, you know, majorities for Likud. Mm-hmm. And so these are very, very stable. It's important to know also that the two sides didn't debate any policy. They tried to depict the other one as weak on certain policies toward Gaza or toward Iran. In fact, the two men, Gantz and Netanyahu, almost to the, there's some very minor nuances that you have to really get to know them to know about. On Gaza, on Iran, on the major issues of Israeli security, they agree completely. They famously work very, very closely together against some other more right-wing, more hawkish people in the cabinet during the 2014 Gaza war. And so there was no policy gap. And what you're seeing really is the social, ethnic gaps among the Jews in Blue and White and Likud. I expect it to remain for a very long time, and it has been around for a very long time. And since there is no solution that anyone expects to find with the Palestinian front, and there's almost complete agreement on the Iranian question, there's nothing else for an election to be about.
Now, I was going to say that there are some people that have said actually that there was this big personality fight, but on a lot of the big issues, it actually showed that Israel wasn't divided. There was quite a lot of consensus.
I would share that. I think that's absolutely what we saw. And so this really was an election that delivered nothing at all. It was just, you know, what the Israel that existed 3 years ago is the exact Israel that exists today. You know, what are we, a week after the election? It actually changed absolutely nothing, and told us that Israelis have sort of, there was a lot of shakeup of Israeli politics after the second Intifada in 2000, when the less policy, the less idea, the less narrative, the less promise of the withdrawal being reciprocated by the Palestinians with peace collapsed in the second Intifada with 150 suicide bombings or whatever number there were. And the left hasn't won an election since 1999. And all of Israeli politics, I mean, we had, for example, one absolutely incredible detail about Israeli political behavior. We had between 1969 and 1999, 30 years of elections, voter turnout in Israel was always between 77 and 81%. Incredibly stable, incredibly high, even though we had a fiscal crisis in 1985 where we debased the currency, and we had the 73 war and the Rabin assassination in 95, deep traumas, deep disruptions, political disruptions, Israelis always voted. And between 1999 and 2001, when the next election came, right after the second Intifada, voter turnout suddenly dropped 15 points to 62%. It has still not recovered to the lowest it ever was before 99. So there's this deep, deep fracture in Israeli politics. It created the modern consensus that there really is no political solution to this conflict with the Palestinians. And that's become the new normal. What was a trauma in the 2000s, that peace is no longer available, is now the new normal. And Israelis vote on more on ethnic, you know, what your neighbor votes, what the people who go to your particular school vote, things like that.
My final question is about then what might cause a transformation, which is the progression of the indictments against Prime Minister Netanyahu. And I think there's a few parts to the question, which is, First of all, to what extent do we think that there's really going to be a move by various politicians just simply to grant him immunity? And I think some commentators have been perhaps guilty of believing that this is, you know, not something that's really going to happen, but there's a possibility that it could just happen and the whole corruption story could go away. So I want to get your sense of that. And then the sense that if it does go ahead and we do move towards a situation where the Prime Minister is facing a criminal trial, to what extent you think that is going to intensify the divisions and whether that's actually going to maybe slightly transform what's happening in Israeli politics. So your view on that?
Netanyahu has been vowing to anyone who will listen that he has absolutely no intention of pursuing legislation to protect him from indictments. And I sense that is a case of, methinks he doth protest too much. He's very, very media shy. He likes to give speeches, but he doesn't like to get interviews. He doesn't like to have Q&As, except in the few days before elections. He's gone several hundred days at a time over the last 10 years, not interviewing with the Israeli press. And the fact that he is now just telling, people all the time and all these interviews at this point, I suspect that he will absolutely pursue it. I suspect that he is, trying to distract people so that he can push some legislation down the road, have it introduced by the coalition partners. We're going to see coalition agreements being written up over the next couple of weeks. And coalition agreements signed between the different parties of the coalition are public, and they're posted to the Knesset website, and we're all going to read them, and we're going to find out if a legislation to create a little bit of a presidential system of protection from indictment while you're in office, something along the French system, will be in those coalition agreements, and then we'll know more. I suspect that. Under Israeli law, just the specifics of the law are that he only has to resign once he is convicted. He does not actually have to resign by law until then. And one last point that's relevant, the Likud party is intensely loyal to its leader. The Labor Party of Israel has had, I believe, something like 12 leadership changes in the last 25 years. The Likud party has had exactly four leaders since 1948. And so Likud is this, it has a culture for generations of deep, deep loyalty. So that's working for him. The fact that he's a prime minister who really could probably force that kind of legislation into the Knesset is working for him. But if the indictment happens and he really is on trial, there's no precedent for a prime minister of Israel continuing to function. And Netanyahu, when he was opposition leader during the Olmert years, when Olmert then had to resign in 2009 on these questions of corruption indictments, Netanyahu, railed against him, delivered speeches in the Knesset. All that will be brought back to sort of pressure him to leave. If he leaves, I suspect that to a lot of observers overseas, maybe who are more liberal and who are a little bit miffed by Netanyahu and who don't like him, they're going to discover, I suspect, that he was never the problem. And the person who will replace him will pursue just about an identical policy, very much status quo, not seeking wars, not moving, an inch on the Palestinian question one way or the other. There's a whole batch of leaders in Likud who would race to replace him. They're all very much along his lines in terms of policy. And if there's an election and without a Netanyahu, Likud will lose the election, then blue and white is not going to deliver a very different prime minister either. Benny Gantz, he speaks much more, moderately. He speaks much more embracingly. He tries to find common ground with the people he's interviewing with or speaking with. But there's no fundamental difference in policy. So in other words, I don't know what will happen, but there are very powerful reasons to go either way. There are very powerful pressures that will be pushing both for him to leave and for him to stay.
Fascinating. Well, Chaviv, thank you so much for your time. We will leave it there, but we've covered a lot of ground, and I'm incredibly grateful. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm now joined by Dalia Sheinlin, a pollster in Israel and a regular writer for 972 magazine. Thank you so much for joining us, Dalia.
Thank you for having me again.
So we spoke during the election campaign, and really sort of your conclusion was, unless Blue and White Party under Benny Gantz sort of win over a chunk of moderate right-wing voters from Likud, they're not really going to win this election. And that didn't really happen, and that's why they lost.
Yeah, that's a very accurate way of putting it. I mean, some people would point to the fact that the right-wing bloc of parties shrunk by two seats, which looks like some progress for the center and left bloc. And of course, the blue and white party did very well with 35 seats. But they would have had to also not only have a big enough bloc of the center and left or be able to form a government some other way, they had to win a significant lead over Likud. So it would have meant, you know, shifting voters from the right to the center-left bloc, but not just any voters. They failed to get Likud voters to defect in significant numbers. And that's, you know, among the reasons why they weren't able to pull a significant lead over Likud. And then, of course, the problem was that not enough people defected blocs. If they had gotten significant numbers of people to defect from right bloc overall and achieved the same result as they did compared to Likud, which is a very slight advantage for Likud in the final count. But if there had been a massive defection from the right, you know, maybe they could have formed the next government. That wasn't the case. And so they would have had, failing that, they would have needed the bigger advantage over Likud, which they didn't get.
And you wrote recently in 972 magazine where you just thought really their campaign just was not strong enough in terms of trying to actually attract some of those voters and even just to sort of mobilize the base. I mean, they didn't talk in detail about their vision for what they would do differently in Israeli politics. They didn't defend kind of rigorously the key institutions of Israeli society. I mean, is it really as simple as just that they ran a bad campaign, and if they would have won a better campaign, they might have won?
Well, I did write, you know, a pretty tough critique of their campaign because I think that they really could have done a better job. I don't think they were coherent enough on the issues. I think they were too busy trying to look like another version of Likud to win over the right, when instead they could have been staking out original territory on issues for people who were considering breaking with the right. But how you run your campaign is only part of the appeal to voters. The other side of the question is who the voters are. So there's top down and bottom up. And the structure of society in terms of who the voters are is a big part of this. And in most surveys, which really haven't changed since about the mid-2000s, there's a pretty stable portion of Israelis who identify as right, left, and center. And the center camp altogether is about a bit more than 25%, you know, 26, 27, depending on the margin of error. And so to some extent, you could look at this and say, well, they got the entire center vote, which is not entirely the case, of course, because we know that they took lots of votes away from Labor. The Labor Party shrunk to a historic low of 6 seats. So they pulled some votes from the center and the moderate left, and maybe some centrists or self-defined centrists, of course, you know, still voted for center-right parties such as Kahlon or even Likud. But in terms of the structure of Israeli society, it looks right now like there is an upper limit in addition to whatever the campaigns can promise and how convincing they can look at the top-down level. And so that's a competing force, right? I don't think that cap, that 26% 27% who identify as centrist, has to be the natural end or the natural limit on the success of center parties. But to go beyond that, they have to run much more sophisticated campaigns or do much better in terms of their political maneuvering than they did. So the combination of having a natural upper limit in the structure of society and, you know, failing to, you know, to do a campaign that generated enthusiasm from anybody beyond the base, I think was what kept them to a limited kind of victory. I mean, it's not a victory at all, but it's a decent result, but it was limited in terms of its ability to have a transfer of power.
In terms of what you know about focus groups and polling, I mean, is it the case that kind of campaign would have been more appealing? I mean, it definitely felt like some of the Gantz adverts and the themes that they were trying to run, that they were trying to be very top level. They were not trying to get into any detail. They did not do anything like mention the words Palestinian state, although they sort of talked about talking to the Palestinians. You know, you had these strange adverts about Gantz's record in Gaza. It was almost like a fear that they wanted to just stay very safe. They wanted to be the tough guy. They didn't want to give anything away. They were exposing to attacks from the right. Do you think they read that right? Or do you think there's actually more of a opening for an honest campaign that really has some serious principles?
I think that their strategic calculation that they needed to appeal to elements of the right-wing voters was the correct calculation. The numbers can't lie on that. It's because of the analysis that I gave you before. However, I do think they made very severe mistakes in how you appeal to the right-wing voters. I think that any voter understands when a candidate is behaving out of fear. And as you point out, if party is fearful to say what it really thinks and what agenda it really harbors, voters sense that. They sense when politicians are not being honest. Sometimes they may vote for them anyway, but they certainly are aware of it. And when it's a politician they don't know, they don't know what he stands for, or they think they might know what he stands for, but he won't come out and say it, it becomes clear that there's, you know, something missing. And I think that that didn't matter for the centrists and moderate left who voted for him because they just wanted to get rid of Netanyahu. But it did matter for the people who might have considered defecting. They didn't want to defect from Likud or from the right to a politician who won't clarify who he is afraid to say what they all think he really thinks, and that doesn't seem very authentic to them, as if he's hiding something. I think that that kind of campaign with a brutal sort of bang them over the head with how tough and mean and military I am is a little bit insulting to the intelligence of those potential defectors. It says, if I just, you know, throw you some kind of fresh meat and show you how much blood I shed in Gaza, then you'll vote for me. And I think that that, personally, I think it's disparaging to the target of those of that campaign, as if that's all they care about, when in fact, you know, what I observed in my writing, because I observed it in my surveys, and also, as you asked, in focus groups, is that among the people from the right who were considering defecting parties to the center, part of where they really break with Netanyahu is their discomfort over how he has treated Israel's democratic institutions, their dislike of his populism, and their dislike of the kind of erosion of the status of Israel's democratic institutions. And to my mind, that would have been a very, you know, genuine and clever and authentic approach to saying, listen, we understand that you're right wing, but we all can agree that Israel should strengthen its democratic institutions. If they had listened to focus groups the way I listened to them, I wonder if they would have heard the same thing. They should have, and I think they should have run a campaign much more focused on those things.
I mean, there was a sprinkling of some of that in certainly some of Gantz's speeches and interviews, but just not enough. I mean, it wasn't
not enough. And I think that the one thing they did try to do, which I think was very noticeable, especially in the beginning, and I gave him some credit for that, maybe not as much as I should have publicly, but I certainly thought it and spoke about it, is that he projected a tone that was very profoundly contrasting to Netanyahu's tone. In other words, I think he probably did hear centrists and even moderate right-wingers saying, we're tired of all this internal division, we're tired of this angry kind of hateful rhetoric coming from Netanyahu, we're tired of Netanyahu leveraging the fear factor to get his votes. And I heard a lot of people say that, especially among those who are undecided, including those who are right-leaning undecided. And I think that in the beginning, he really portrayed a different tone. It was an Obama-esque kind of, there's no left and right, let's unify. Also in his style, his actual speaking style, he was very sort of warm and, you know, inviting and enthusiastic, and it was positive. And I thought, you know, tone and style are important as well as content. I understand that as a campaign, you know, strategist. But I think that that ultimately was overshadowed, first of all, by the fact that he became defensive later on in the campaign, which is exactly what Netanyahu wanted. Netanyahu was attacking him on bizarre things, and he fell for the bait. And then also the, you know, the failure to be able to get back to a significant concrete agenda based on issues. The combination kind of counteracted the possible strength of that significantly different tone and style, the anti-populist, you know, mature adult kind of tone and style that he was projecting in the beginning.
Right. And I mean, we've read a lot in the UK about the sort of demise of the left in Israel and people seeing that as a symptom of sort of Israel's general direction politically. I mean, could you tell us a bit about the story of Labour in this election? I mean, is that just the latest phase in a long decline, a sort of party that sort of lost its identity? Is it reversible? Is this a short-term migration to the blue-white party? Is there hope? Or do you think that, you know, that's really it for the Labour Party in terms of its support?
Let me start by asking why we should have hope for the Labour Party. I mean, as Tippi Livni used to love to say, the party's only a vehicle for advancing an actual vision and ideology. And I think what the problem with the, you know, for voters was that it was not clear to anybody what Labour really stood for either. So I don't see the point in, you know, romantic nostalgia for the party just for the sake of it. The party is, you know, just a vehicle. Now, I would stick with my basic thesis that there's both a top-down campaign element to success or failure of a party and a matter of the structure of society. And if you consider that only about 20% of all Israeli adults self-identify as left-wing, that includes Jews and Arabs, who break up their votes between two Arab parties, Meretz and Labor, and then some of them who wanted to vote for blue and white, you know, mostly to get rid of Netanyahu, that just doesn't leave very much room for any of those parties to do very well, especially if you consider that Labor's, you know, a Zionist party, which means that they have even fewer votes to break up, because among Jews, the self-identification of left or moderate left combined is less than 15%, you know, between 12 and 15%. So that's just not a lot of votes to go around. Now, in addition to that structural factor, I think Labour made profound mistakes in managing the campaign, and well before the campaign. I have to say that a lot of these mistakes are directly attributed to the new leader, Avi Gabay, who came in with a certain hubris that he's from a completely different party, completely different, you know, political background, but that he alone would be capable of doing something that is notoriously difficult, and that's lead the Labour Party at a time when the left is out of fashion in Israel. He wouldn't be the first person to try and fail, but he really should have known better than to think that he could overcome the same obstacles that the others faced with nothing but force. And when I say force, you know, the force of his own conviction that he was correct, and he was clearly not correct, to begin his leadership of the party by trying to pander to the right, by making statements that alienated the left and didn't fool the right. Labour is considered a, you know, strictly a left-wing party in Israeli perceptions. Therefore, he would have had to be much more sophisticated about how to win over the right, and had a lot less natural attraction for the right than a party of generals like Blue and White. After that, you know, his much publicized breakup with Tzipi Livni basically focused all the attention on Labour's internal troubles, you know, internal party disputes. And then on top of all that, he ran a campaign that for the first part focused entirely on coalition politics, thinking that he was very bright to promise voters that he would never sit in a coalition with Netanyahu. Well, I don't think too many voters really believed that he was going to be invited into a coalition with Netanyahu to begin with. Mm. And the truth is, voters hate negotiations over coalition politics during the elections. They may do it themselves by election day. But to say that that's your brand, that that's what your party stands for, is basically to say your party stands for nothing. So I think that he had a lot of problems in terms of how he ran the campaign. By the way, you could tell that Labour itself ultimately recognized failures because the polls were sinking like, you know, a punctured balloon, and they shifted their campaign from a giant, you know, from gigantic focus on Avi Gabay in the beginning, where his billboards of his face were plastered all over the country. They shifted the campaign quite radically to focusing on the list of candidates. I assume they were doing focus groups and heard everybody saying how nice the list is. Yeah. You know, the candidates who were on the list who were young and, you know, had, so many of them had been active members of Knesset and, you know, had good reputation and strong association with, you know, social welfare themes that were kind of lost in this election, and that they really didn't see the appeal in Avi Gabay. So you could tell that they did try, you know, at the last minute to shift their campaign strategy, but I think by then the damage had been done.
So just finally, I want to just touch on the issue of turnout and what that tells us about sort of motivation in Israeli politics and how people are sort of shut out. And it's a two-part question, which I understand will need a considered answer. But first of all, the impact of the low turnout in the Arab sector, and then also turnout overall, and what it tells us about sort of where we are on a trajectory that, you know, there was a time where, you know, turnout was extremely high in the Israeli elections and where we are on that.
Yeah. Well, let's start with overall turnout. Overall turnout was about 68, over just around 68%. And that is about a 4-point decline from last time. It's still healthy by Western democratic standards. But as you point out, it's a significant drop from the earlier years. Up until 1999, Israel had an average of about 80% turnout, usually ranging between 78 and 82%. That dropped off a cliff in 2001, partly because of a near total boycott of the Arab community, but not only, also because the Jewish vote dropped. And over the years, it crept back up to about this range. So it's other than 2015, this has been a pretty normal turnout level for Israeli national elections. As you point out, there was a major gap between the Jewish vote and the Arab vote. The Arab vote is a little bit disputed. It's being reported at anywhere between, I've heard estimates of between 48.5% to 56%. The reason why it's a little bit difficult to assess perfectly is because we only have turnout by ballot station. So you can only assess turnout in areas that you know are inhabited only by Arabs. But of course, many Arabs live in mixed cities. Not the majority, but a substantial enough number that it becomes hard to estimate because you don't know who's voting in a mixed city or in a mixed ballot station. I will also point out that I really hope that you're able to get on the show Palestinian Arab citizens of Israel who can speak intelligently about the kinds of forces that were calling for boycott in this election due to factors that I will explain. But I think that it's really worth hearing from them how sensitive the issue of voting became because of the deep question of whether there's any value in voting for the legislature when the parties that sit in Knesset really haven't been able to, you know, to be effective at protecting Arabs from what is essentially an onslaught of legislation and anti-Arab rhetoric over the last decade. It's not a new thing. It's for the last decade already. Now, there have been accusations, you know, I think one narrative about why the Arabs voted with low turnout is because some people say they were very disappointed in the leadership. Their own party, the joint list of which combined three-hour parties broke up, now leaving two, and many people thought that was a shame and maybe, you know, felt disappointed. But, you know, you have to remember that the reason why those three parties united to begin with and then subsequently, you know, had difficulty staying together because they were so different ideologically, the only reason they united to begin with was because the Israeli politicians from the previous government raised the turnout threshold in order to try to make it difficult for the Arab parties to cross. So this goes back to that decade-long assault on the sort of political position of Arab citizens, Palestinian citizens of Israel. And I think that the other, you know, really colossal factor in the decision of those citizens to vote was the nation-state law. I don't think you can have this conversation without taking into account the devastating blow that the nation-state law meant for Arab citizens of Israel when it was passed, you know, determining that there's sort of a constitutionally anchored primacy of the Jewish citizens over the Arab citizens and demoting the status of Arab citizens in Israel in various symbolic and maybe non-symbolic ways. So I think those were the two main factors that overshadowed a very deep dilemma that many people had in this community and leading to somewhere around 50% or just over 50% turnout. But again, I've seen the range of numbers. We'll have to wait for more significant analysis to try to get the final word.
Just on a final question, although I said the one before was a final question, but I realize this is probably a good one to ask you because of what you said before about focus groups and people on the moderate right, is that if this indictment against Prime Minister Netanyahu continues, as we expect it will, and the Attorney General formally indicts him and he looks like he's heading towards a criminal trial, do you see that something will change in the opinions of some of these people if he, as expected, sort of carries on trying to undermine the motivations and the character of some of these institutions of state that guarantee the rule of law? Do you think that's going to cause a much greater discomfort among some of these voters and lead to perhaps a bigger shift in Israeli politics? Or do you think that people will just go along with it and just, you know, think, oh, maybe these charges aren't true and not feel as uncomfortable? I mean, I'd be interested to know your thoughts on that.
Unless we go into a new election, it doesn't matter. In other words, it does matter to me as a public opinion researcher and somebody who thinks about, you know, Israeli democracy. But whatever people's reaction to Netanyahu's reaction may be, unless we're going into an election cycle again, it's not really important, because what really will determine the future of the government is what Netanyahu does and what his party does. And does his party try to pressure him to resign, or does his party try to pass an immunity law before that? I mean, he doesn't have to resign anyway by law in Israel if he's under indictment. But if an immunity law is passed, what Israelis are calling the French law, it further protects him on the legal level. And it also kind of generates strong moral kind of, you know, legitimacy for him continuing as prime minister. And in that case, I can only expect support for his continued leadership to either remain, you know, probably remain stable. I don't think it will grow. If his party turns against him and says, you know, this does not look good for the Likud, this does not look good for Israeli democracy, you know, finds a way to help elegantly escort him out of the prime minister's position, I think that people will probably follow the lead and say, you know, he's been in power for a long time. His own party thinks it's not good that he governs. I imagine we would see survey research showing growing support for him leaving the position of prime minister. But again, unless there's actually elections, it's not clear what those hypothetical shifts will mean. By the time elections come around, if that's the case, people might say, well, the Likud did the right thing, so we support them again. I mean, it gets to be rather speculative.
Yeah, it's difficult to see. Dalia, thank you so much. We covered so much ground there, but it's always great to have you on and get your insight, and hopefully we'll get you on again soon. Thank you so much.
Great. My pleasure.